You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, over 500,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, but it can be hard for the human mind to comprehend loss on that scale. A psychologist tells us why large-scale tragedies can numb our emotional response. Now, conservatives gathered in Orlando over the weekend for the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC. A number of prominent Republicans spoke at the event, including former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and former President Donald Trump.
Hello, CPAC. Do you miss me yet? Do you miss me yet?
It was Trump's first speech since leaving office last month. He criticized many of President Biden's policies and laid out issues Republicans should campaign on to take back control of Congress and the White House. He and other speakers also continued to make false claims about the 2020 election results. The remarks came as Republicans continue to figure out what role Trump should have within the party following his loss to Biden and the January riot at the U.S. Capitol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should former President Trump play a prominent role in leading the GOP into the future, or would the party be better off with a quieter role for him? Do you want to see Trump run for president again in 2024, or do you want to see the torch pass to someone else? What issues do you think are winners for conservatives heading into midterm elections next year? And if you're a Democrat, what do you make of the state of the Republican Party today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Tim Hagel is an associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about this event, CPAC. It's an annual gig. It's the conservative wing of the Republican Party generally considered. How does it fit into overall Republican politics?
Well, that's a little hard to say, and it does vary from time to time. A number of years ago, I met people were talking about how at one point Ron Paul was the darling of the CPAC event in, I think, 2011 or something like that. And so that was kind of a little bit more libertarian leaning group. This time it seemed to be more of a Trump leaning, which might be more like a populist kind of group, which sort of kind of goes along with the Ron Paul stuff too. But they tend to be a little bit different from what we would normally think of as establishment type Republicans, that they're more the grassroots folks.
And in 2016, we saw candidate Donald Trump skip out on CPAC, and some of the organizers of it criticized him for that. What do you think of this change now? 2016, he skips the event, goes on and wins the nomination and the presidency, of course. And this year, he is the main event at CPAC.
Yeah. Well, obviously, times change, and it's a big difference between if you're a candidate and as a candidate running as more or less an outsider. And I don't recall exactly what it was that Trump did that particular weekend or week back in 2016 or whenever. This time, of course, he's the former president and all of the baggage and history that goes with that. And so it's no surprise that a former president is a keynote speaker, and especially given the circumstances, and as your lead-in indicated, that he's still making comments along the lines of a stolen election and so forth, and that does tend to resonate with a certain group of folks, particularly his supporters, and so it's no surprise that he wanted to kind of, I don't know if piggyback's quite the right word there, but wanted to capitalize on that, especially given his comments along the lines of that he's not going to give up the fight, not just sort of fade away. And he's looking forward to, in particular, 2022, and kind of teased a little bit about 2024.
And there had been some reporting that former President Trump was considering splitting off into a separate party from the Republican Party. There's been some polling suggesting that some of his supporters would like to split off. Some polling suggesting that other Republicans would want to split off from a Trump-led Republican Party. Here's what President Trump had to say about that.
We're not starting new parties. You know, they kept saying, he's going to start a brand new party. We have the Republican Party. It's going to unite and be stronger than ever before. I am not starting a new party. That was fake news. Fake news, no. Wouldn't that be brilliant? Let's start a new party and let's divide our vote so that you can never win. No, we're not interested in that.
So Donald Trump, it sounds like he's all in with the Republican Party for now. How is that an important clarification, Tim, given that reporting that he was thinking of splitting off at one point?
Yes, I think it is. Actually, it's very important. It's probably the main bit of news, I think, to take away from that, aside from anything else he was saying. As you indicated, that there are certain Trump supporters who never really were happy with, again, the establishment side of the Republican Party. They didn't think that they fought hard enough. And that was one of the things, of course, that attracted them and even some people that weren't necessarily Republicans, but leaning conservatives, that they like Trump. And even though it became a bit of a joke that say, oh, well, he fights, you know, kind of a thing. Well, that really was an important criterion. On the other hand, you have more of the establishment type Republicans who really disliked Trump and were hoping to split off. And of course, there were some famously the never Trumpers, so to speak, that never did support Trump even after he became president. And so they would like to split off. And so you're going to have those tensions in the party, too. We see that from time to time in the Democratic Party, too, in terms of different wings kind of arguing with each other and sometimes becomes very, very vocal about it. But I think that the idea that maybe a Trump would split off like we saw. Well, maybe I shouldn't say we saw, but we know about in the Bull Moose Party back with Teddy Roosevelt and so forth, where basically splitting the Republican Party then guaranteed Woodrow Wilson and the Democrats a victory. And so it's smart to say, no, we're going to stick with the Republican Party and work with it rather than trying to form some new party.
We're talking to Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, looking at the big CPAC conference over the weekend and the role of Donald Trump in the future of the Republican Party. You can join in with your thoughts on that issue at 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen to Florida Senator Rick Scott. This is speaking on Fox News Sunday, being asked if the Republican Party is the Donald Trump Party. Here's how he responded.
It's the voters' party. I mean, it always has been the voters' party. Let's go back to 2010 in my primary. Every Republican, I think, in the country had endorsed my opponent, and I won. I talked to President Trump about a week ago, and I told him, this is my job. My job is to help Republican senators win all across the country, and he made a commitment to me to help me do that. I believe he's going to be helpful, but I think other Republicans are going to be helpful.
And that is in contrast to Donald Trump's naming a bunch of senators and House members, especially those who voted in favor of his impeachment, and suggesting he would not, as Senator Scott said, he would not support them. How big a role do you see Donald Trump playing in races, especially with those who voted to impeach him?
You know, that's going to be an interesting question going forward, that my understanding, and I didn't look at this directly, I heard this from another analyst, that of the senators that got named, the Republican senators, there were seven, but only one of them is actually up for re-election in 2022. And so it may be, you know, Trump expressing his dislike and unhappiness that they didn't vote with him on the impeachment and conviction issues, whether it was in the House or in the Senate version of that. But, you know, whether he's going to go out and actively campaign or, you know, as opposed to simply saying, well, yeah, I support your opponent, whoever it is. But we know, and especially we know here in Iowa and the Midwest generally, that, you know, unless you actually get out there and start campaigning for the other person, it may not have that much effect. But we'll see what happens and how much Trump is going to continue to do that. And I think along those lines, in terms of Trump's future generally and how much sway he has in the Republican Party, it's going to make a big difference as to how he handles 2022, that to a certain extent he undercut his not authority, but his gravitas in all of this with what happened in Georgia. The fact that he, you know, continued to emphasize the presidential election results rather than focusing on trying to win those two Senate seats in Georgia. And as a result, they both went to Democrats and Republicans lost control. And I think that that hurt him with certain segments of the Republican Party that were at least willing to go along with Trump, even if they didn't like his style or his personality.
We're talking about the state of the Republican Party after this weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference in Florida. Tim Hagel is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of where the Republican Party stands today? Did you watch former President Trump speak at the event? What role should he play, if any, in the Republican Party going forward? If you consider yourself a Republican, how prominent a role do you want for the former president in your party? If you're watching from the outside, what do you want to see? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about this weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando. Former President Trump made his first speech since leaving office. He criticized President Biden on border policies, school reopening timelines, and more. Tim Hagel is our guest, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you're Republican or not, do you want to see the former president playing a big role in the Republican Party in the next 2 years? How about 4 years? Do you want to see him run for president again? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Tim, looking at the 2024 presidential race, I will not ask you to predict whether Donald Trump will run or not. I wouldn't ask anybody to predict that. But the fact that he's holding out this notion and keeping it open, what does that mean if I'm another Republican candidate wanting to start laying the groundwork for a presidential campaign, but not wanting to step on Donald Trump's toes and angering his supporters?
Yeah, and that's actually the precise problem that a lot of folks, you mentioned DeSantis and Kristi Noem, Governor Kristi Noem is another one, maybe Pompeo, a lot of folks that ran in 2016 that lost to Donald Trump that would like to have another shot at it. And you're right that if Trump wants to get in, that they probably would not. Now, I think probably you'd have a few people do so, but to some extent, could see a repeat of what happened to the Democrats in 2016, where Hillary Clinton basically cleared the field until Bernie Sanders kind of came on strong as the only opposition. Still, I think that Trump probably would have some opposition, and you could even have people that would say, look, I support Donald Trump's policies and in all of this, but he's reached a point where he's maybe too old to be president kind of a thing, approach to it. Now, that, of course, would depend on Trump's health at the time. If he's still vigorous and everything, it might be a harder sell. But yeah, the people still need to, if they're interested in it, they need to lay the groundwork. And it's from Trump's perspective that he can kind of put that tease out there to a certain extent. And that still gives him a little bit of power, that if he flat out says, no, I'm not running, then he kind of loses some of his cachet along those lines.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Michael with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me, Rob. Love the show. So I'm calling from a left-leaning perspective. I tend to vote Democrat and lean left with most of my positions. That being said, from my view, I think the most characterizing thing, or the most sort of distinguishing thing you can say about the modern Republican Party, both in Wisconsin and nationally, is party above all seems to be sort of the defining characteristic. They profess to be the party of the people while ignoring calls for, redistricting within the state or the legalization of marijuana that most people support. The Republican Party just seems to be party above all, with really a lack of integrity.
Michael, thanks for the call. A view from a critic of the Republican Party, of course, Tim, but what do you think of what Michael had to say, seeing the Republicans being a party above all party?
Well, that's partly the argument that some Republicans had been making as well, and why they split when you saw the impeachment in the House and the trial in the Senate, that you had a couple of Republicans that split and were considered traitors from the party. And that kind of was the idea that, well, you've got to go with the party, even if we don't like maybe some of the things Trump's doing. And other people said, no, that this is stuff that we wouldn't put up with a Democrat, so we shouldn't put up with it with a Republican. And that's kind of the fight that we're having. Although to a certain extent, that same argument can be had among Democrats, where often you don't see much in the way of
of dissent from the party line, whatever it happens to be. And that's kind of a function, I suspect, of the two-party system, where you have to some extent, stay with your party. And maybe you don't like it all the time, or don't like particular people necessarily. But if you don't stick with the party, then the other side wins. And this is maybe unlike what we see in some European countries, where you have a very large or a larger number of parties. And so those kinds of splits and so things can kind of form and reform, whereas we're pretty much stuck. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I kind of like the two-party system, but we're sort of in that thing where it's okay, you know, either we're with our group and we can win some of the time, or if we're not with our group, and then we're going to lose a bigger chunk of the time.
Thanks for that call, Michael. You know, I'm going to throw something at you, Tim, that's been on my mind lately. Talk about earmarks coming back. You know, these special things that, hey, Congressman Rob, we know you're not with our party, but vote with us on this. You get a museum renovation in your district or whatever. And I've seen some people talk about, you know, that being sort of a lubricant for cooperation and compromise. Without that, what are you going to do but vote with your party and not anger your party supporters if you can't get anything to show for it? Do you have thoughts on the possible return of these earmarks, Tim?
Yeah, you know, you're kind of hitting at that pro and con aspect to them, that on the positive side, you do have the possibility of maybe getting some more things done, peeling a few votes off from the opposition. And maybe especially in a time we've got now where both the House and the Senate are very evenly split, especially the Senate, of course, at 50-50 with the vice president casting deciding votes as necessary. The House is not that different, really. Democrats have a very slim margin. So you peel off a few Democrats Republicans can get something that they want. The problem is that then that's prone to abuse as well, where all of a sudden you're paying for what is usually termed pork barrel kinds of things that you don't have much use for. There was, you know, famously a bridge to nowhere in Alaska, for example, but that's good for jobs in Alaska, or good for, you know, whatever kind of a job creating thing that brings money into your district. And so that's good because you're bringing home the bacon, so to speak, and, you know, providing that kind of thing that you can talk about to your voters the next time you come up for re-election, which, of course, in the House is almost a constant thing these days. And so the pro and con, it got to the point where it was too much of a con, and so we got rid of them. But now it seems with Congress being almost in a perpetual stalemate, that maybe you need to have some return to that. And maybe given that Republicans have, to some extent at least, gotten away from concern about the deficit and spending and so forth, although we're starting to see a little bit of that coming back, that maybe earmarks might be the way to go to kind of loosen things up a little bit and get more things done.
We'll have to do a whole segment on that so I don't keep throwing it into random conversations. We're talking to Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, talking mainly about this weekend's CPAC convention and the role of former President Trump in the Republican Party. Back to your calls now. Frank is with us in Door County. Frank, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm looking at this from a pragmatic point of view of a Republican. Senator McConnell on the Senate floor more than chastised the president, then president, for his behavior, and said and used the word "not accountable." He was not held accountable yet. I would think that for those running for wishing to run for the presidency in the Republican Party, the "yet" is yet out there. For them, their best hope, as Senator McConnell then just went on and said that he would gladly support him as President Trump if he ran again, the dichotomy in the words. But he's the whole idea of being held accountable by the legal system that would take the former President Trump out of the equation for those who wished to run for presidency from the Republican Party. I think that that's McConnell's hope in some ways, that the "yet" comes down.
Frank, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, we don't know what's in Senator McConnell's head, Leader McConnell's head, Tim, but that possibility that due to circumstances beyond Mitch McConnell's control, if Donald Trump weren't able to run for president, it might not be such a bad thing for Mitch McConnell and like minds in the Republican Party.
Oh, exactly. And certainly that's a number of Republicans would certainly breathe a sigh of relief if somehow Trump were taken off the board. And it can be legal. We also don't know what's going to happen on the civil side of things, but we know that New York is looking into Trump's tax returns, that the court said that they can get a hold of those. And so we just don't know what's going to happen. But even aside from that, from any kind of legal challenge, there's still the voters. There are a number of Republicans that certainly are unhappy with even if they don't blame Trump specifically for kind of the riot that turned into a mob, violent mob attacking attacking the House, the Capitol. They're still unhappy with sort of the response and sort of what happened after that, kind of the whole sort of thing, and maybe don't want to revisit that. But on the other hand, if the voters are willing to get past that in a couple of years, and as McConnell said, well, if he's the nominee, then I've got to support him.
Thanks a lot for that call. Tim, in our last minute or so, what are you going to be watching for between now and, let's say, congressional midterm elections next year to see where the Republican Party is going, if they can suture up some of these splits?
Well, to some extent, it's going to depend on what happens in Iowa with the caucuses. But usually when we have caucuses in the midterm elections before a caucus, where we would think we're going to have an open election, is who comes to visit, who comes to help state legislators and the congressional candidates here in Iowa and else, and for other places that where you have districts that maybe are very competitive in one way or another. If you're having people, whether it's DeSantis or Pompeo or Noem or anybody else, or Nikki Haley is another one, if they're out there helping other people, then they're getting their name across, they're making friends, and those are the folks that you look to that maybe are going to have a run for the presidency. And of course, we still have to wait and see what Donald Trump does.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. We talked to him about this weekend's Conservative Political Action Conference in Orlando and the future role of former President Trump in the Republican Party. Still time for you to weigh in with your thoughts on Twitter. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Let us know what you think. Again, that's on Twitter at Central Time WPR. Coming up, as the number of lives lost to COVID-19 keeps going up, now past the 500,000 mark in the United States, our emotional response might be going down. A psychologist joins us for a look at why that can be. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, COVID, of course, was bad this year, but flu numbers were way, way down. We'll look at why that is and what it can mean for the next flu season. Now, when the number of COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. jumped from 400,000 to 500,000, you might not have felt that different about it. But losing 100,000 more lives in just a little over a month is a lot. Psychologists say that in the face of large-scale tragedies, we can experience psychic numbing. Research shows that as deaths go up, our empathy can actually go down. So how can we change that within ourselves, and should we want to change that? Shyla Mergain is a psychologist at UW Health. She specializes in health psychology, among other areas. Shyla, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, some studies show that when the number of victims lost to a tragedy increases even from just 1 to 2, our empathy doesn't necessarily go up, it may even go down a little. Can you talk about this phenomenon called psychic numbing?
Absolutely. And I think it really explains why so many of us feel a bit numb. The number of 500,000 deaths seems too big to get our heads and hearts around. I know that for myself, when we passed the death toll past 100,000, that was really vivid. And there was a sense of horror when they predicted over 250,000 deaths. But as the death toll keeps continuing to rise, many of us have become desensitized to it. We feel a sense of numbness. And part of that is adaptive, in that if we just felt overwhelmed by grief, we wouldn't be able to function. And it's really allowed how many of us to get through all the unpredictability of 2020. But there can be some negative consequences to psychic numbing. In particular, we can stop caring and stop following CDC safety guidelines and spread the disease.
I wonder, is there a right midpoint here? Because I'll speak personally. I wouldn't want to feel like I was numb to all this hardship and suffering. On the other hand, it doesn't do anybody good any good if I'm overwhelmed by it and devastated and constantly meditating on the tragedy here. I don't know, what is a healthy way to try to respond to that?
That's such a great question, because we don't want to be flooded to the point of incapacitation. Instead, I really encourage people to think about creating some space or a ritual where they can do some mourning. It's really grief work. And I think it's really at the core of our humanity. We don't want to become habituated to horror and really have respect for life and reverence for life and respect for death. And one example that University of Wisconsin recently was encouraging was Thursday mornings, MOURNINGS. And Omar Poehler, who's at the office of the provost in the School of Education, did this to acknowledge the immense loss and the death toll. So it's not just become a number, abstract and impersonal. And he sets aside and encourages others, and there's the University of Wisconsin is really spearheading this, for 10 minutes on a Thursday morning to stop and right at 10 o'clock and honor the lives lost to COVID. And in particular, what he does that I think is so personal is he takes a few moments to learn about the life of a stranger who had been lost or to COVID-19. So it really makes it personal, because as you said, if we think about, you know, 500,000 people, it feels so abstract. It's easy to just ignore it. But when you bring it home to the individual story, then it can really feel relatable, and we can have that compassion and empathy and do some of the grief work, which keeps us, I think, healthy as humans.
And that makes me think, too, we're talking about how we deal with this as individuals, but in normal times, we deal with a lot of our grief as groups. You know, we go to a funeral or memorial or wake or something like that. We're evolved in some ways to celebrate and to mourn together. How much has the loss of being able to do that, especially in person, made it harder for us to cope with this?
It's huge. And with psychic numbing, we don't want to become hardened to others around us, their losses. So we certainly are going to know people who have lost loved ones or our relatives to COVID-19. And we don't want to become hardened to that. And so many people are not having those rituals of funerals. And a really important point, the researcher David Kessler, who writes a lot about grief, he talks about grief requires witnessing. That we need somebody just to be present with the loss, not to fix it, not to point out the silver lining, but just to be there as a witness. And I think in our own grief work about COVID, just spending a little time bearing witness to the deaths and the suffering and the magnitude, but also just to people in our lives who have experienced loss, just be present with them. They don't need you to fix it or reframe it, just to be present. And that is really healing. That is, I think, good soul work for us to really open our hearts to one another and our common humanity.
I also wonder just if the human brain has the capacity to think in terms of hundreds of thousands. I mean, when a lot of our current faculties evolved, there weren't 500,000 people on the planet. And when we grow up, we don't grow up around 500,000 people. We grow up around a small group of individuals that we know. Well, is this just something that in some ways is beyond our capacity?
I think that's such a great point. We struggle to comprehend large numbers. It's easy to understand the problem facing a single person. And that is why I think when the news really highlights an individual story that feels really relatable versus just seeing the ticker of yet another 1,000 deaths today, that feels very not relatable. And so when we are thinking about this, you know, trying to find the individual stories, seeing that person in front of you, making it personal can be much more easy to connect with and feel that compassion and empathy, which is such a core part of I think, again, our humanity.
Shaila, I want to key in on one particular group of people, the people who have seen a lot of the hardship up front, people who work obviously in healthcare, emergency rooms, hospices, things like that. who have had this daily toll of seeing individual people in front of them suffering. Do you have thoughts on them? I mean, I'm hearing stories about PTSD and worries about how this is going to affect people who have been through this on the front lines. What kind of thoughts do you have for them?
Oh, that's such a great question. And we are seeing a lot of burnout. And I was just reading an article about what was called the third wave of the pandemic, which means we're nearing the end. We can see the light at the end of the tunnel. But often when that happens, people can start to feel a lot of despair and despondency and stop engaging in that self-care and just feeling like they're at their wit's end, like they have nothing left to give. And so self-care is incredibly important. We're still in winter here in Wisconsin, and so many of our coping strategies aren't available to us. So just taking good care of yourself, eating well, sleeping well, reaching out to friends, trying to foster a positive attitude, to focus on what you can control. There's a lot that feels very uncontrollable still, but focus on those things that you can influence, such as following COVID-19 safety guidelines, fostering a little bit of joy, practicing gratitude, fostering habits, all that stuff can make a difference and keep ourselves resilient, which we're going to need for the next couple months till we're on the other side of this.
As we wrap up, can you, I guess, give people permission to take care of themselves and find joy? Because I think there might be some guilt in taking that moment to do that.
Absolutely. We can feel like, oh, we don't have time or there's too much to do. And so I just encourage people to think about spending even 5 minutes focused on your own self-care, thinking about one activity you can do, one action step, and also not to get isolated. This is time to really reach out for support and stay connected to one another.
Shyla, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been a joy. Thank you.
Shyla Morgain is a psychologist at UW Health, where she specializes in health psychology. She talked to us about why it's hard for us to internalize and cope with, in some ways, the increasing number of deaths from COVID-19. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. This month marks the program's 10th anniversary here on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life host Maureen McCollum reflecting on one of her favorite stories about a winter sport.
This month, we're celebrating 10 years of Wisconsin Life on WPR. To honor this milestone, I've asked some of our producers to choose their favorite stories to share with our listeners. Then it came time for me to choose my favorite story. How can I choose a favorite? I really love them all. But there was one story that felt perfect for this moment. Ladies and gentlemen, I take you to a night of broomball in lacrosse.
Come on, Jake. Back.
Broomball is a lot like ice hockey, except players wear shoes and use a ball instead of a puck. The game originated in Canada in the early 20th century and eventually made its way to lacrosse, where bar-sponsored teams play weekly during most winters. This story brings me so much joy. It shows how Wisconsinites are so resilient and will do anything to stay active and happy in the winter. Plus, this is one of the few times I've featured my friends in a story. I've done thousands of stories in my life, and only like two or three of them includes a friend. And I really, really miss my friends right now. Hearing their voices warms my heart, and it reminds me that one day this pandemic will pass, and we can get back to our normal lives, cheering each other on, doing the weird things we all love to do in Wisconsin. I hope you enjoy your journey with me to a night of broomball in lacrosse.
Mike Brogan. Basically, I'm kind of the coordinator for the league. My other job is park and recreation director for Holman. I've been playing since 1990. Broomball is essentially kind of hockey rules, a little slimmed down and made a little easier. We use a kind of a mini soccer ball that's about the size of a softball. You use a broom, but it's not really a broom anymore. It used to be brooms. Actually, there's a few players that still have brooms at play, but they're mostly kind of a molded head, but without skates, so you're running on the ice. Most of the players would have broom ball shoes, which most of the world doesn't know what those are, but they're quite unique with kind of a Chuck Taylor type of look with the big spongy bottom.
Go ahead, Rachel.
My full name is Rachel Leering, and I'm playing for the Animal House team. I officially started 5 years ago, and I actually played for our rivals, John's team. I like to play broomball because it's definitely a great activity in the wintertime when normally people just mope on their couches and watch TV all winter or sit in the bars. And this way you actually get out and get some exercise sweat yourself up, and it's fun. And it's nice because I'm a little competitive, so having a nice sport in the winter is kind of nice to bring that out.
Come on, Nick, clear it out.
Nick Fallon's. I got icicles on my eyebrows right now. That's why I love broomball. It could be 30 below, but you're still sweating outside. And plus, anybody can play it. Anybody from 18 to, look at Jane out there. She's probably 42. And if you get sweet jerseys like we do, oh, you win every game.
Use it. Hey, house.
My name's Louis Parrish, and I've been playing broomball for, I think this will be my fourth year. I play for the Animal House, which is a bar downtown La Crosse. A lot of times go after the game. It's really fun. I used to play hockey too, so it's real similar to hockey, which I like.
He likes to throw cheap shots out there.
Yeah, that's the opponent talking smack. Usually typical when he's down. So yeah, there's a lot of John in this game, but for the most part, everybody's friends, and it's a good time. Even when it's negative 30 out, it's still fun to get out here. Well, it looks like I got to go out in the ice. So.
My name is Pat Scheller. I play for John's Bar, the oldest established brew ball team in the city. I've been playing for 33 years.
Right back, Pat. Right back.
My favorite brew ball story? I think the fact that I have been ejected several times. And I've played with people 30 years ago that I'm still friends with, and I'm making new friends this year. I think that's what I like. And I'm 56 years old, and I'm outside doing something in the middle of the winter, 5 degrees above zero.
That was a night of broomball in La Crosse, recorded back in 2013. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, one silver lining in the pandemic season, the flu hasn't been bad. We'll find out how COVID precautions helped put the brakes on seasonal influenza and what the future could hold. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Johnson & Johnson's new vaccine has been approved. It requires just a single dose. It could be a game changer. Dr. Anthony Fauci joins Jen White and answers your questions. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, one unexpected side effect of the coronavirus pandemic has been its impact on other known respiratory viruses, especially the flu. Hospitalizations and deaths from the flu around the world and in Wisconsin are down dramatically from a year ago. Catherine Wu looked into why and what could happen in the next season. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic covering science. Her recent piece is called "The Pandemic Broke the Flu." Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, there's this worry, and you write about this, that, okay, COVID, and if we have a bad flu season on top of that, that's going to put more strain on health professionals and doctors in hospitals. What ended up happening? Really dramatic, Catherine.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. For a lot of the summer, there were a lot of health professionals preparing for what they called, you know, the worst possible scenario, that there was going to be this twindemic of the flu and COVID happening all at once, and people would be having the same symptoms and coming into hospitals. That turned out to absolutely not be the case. COVID kind of kept tearing across the nation at the start of respiratory virus season, which usually starts in around, you know, late November, early December. But there have just been absolutely no cases of the flu. One lab that I talked to tested 20,000 people for the flu, and there were zero cases, which is just remarkable.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We had 1,200 hospitalizations from flu last year by around this time, 26 deaths. This is by mid-February. This year, 11 hospitalizations, no deaths. I mean, this is not just a little blip. This is huge. What are people pointing to, Catherine, as the cause of such a huge decline?
Yeah, I think this created a lot of dissonance for people because people were wondering, well, we have this huge respiratory virus problem. Why did the flu disappear when we've still been struggling with COVID? And I think there's a lot of different things going on. I talked to scientists about a lot of different hypotheses, none of which are really mutually exclusive. I think one really big thing is we have to think about the fact that even though we're dealing with two respiratory viruses here, the coronavirus and the flu virus, which is really many different types of viruses, flu viruses have been around the human population for a really, really long time. We've had time to get used to the flu. We know how to deal with the flu. The flu is also probably, you know, a little bit less transmissible. And a lot of people have had a lot of flu viruses in their life. We have some existing immunity. The way I kind of think about it is, you know, we've already got some pre-existing armor to the flu, whether that's, you know, human-made or just what naturally occurs in us as we get exposed to a virus over and over. When this new coronavirus came around, we were completely defenseless against it. And so we've had to really beat it back with everything we've got this year. But even when we haven't, I think, 100% committed to measures like masking, distancing, hand washing, staying at home, even partial adherence to those measures have been enough to really drive the flu down. I think another big thing that's going on is just we've been traveling less this year. Kids aren't in school. There are just so many fewer places for the flu to travel, to pass between people. It's really just had fewer opportunities to move around between people. And there's also some suspicion that there could be things happening at an individual level. If you're sick with one virus, it might be harder to get another. But really, it's this huge amalgamation of us having this like massive behavioral changeover compared to previous years, and that working especially well against viruses like the flu.
Well, I hate to find a dark cloud in the silver lining behind our dark cloud here, but there are worries you write about that just because flu isn't bad this year, that doesn't mean it's not going to come back. And in some ways, it may hurt our ability to predict and make vaccinations for next year's flu. How does that work?
Yeah, it's a little tricky. You know, I certainly don't want to paint this as a bad thing. Really, the bottom line here is we have really demonstrated that we have incredibly powerful measures against the flu. The tricky thing about this is we know the flu is going to come back. We've not eradicated the flu. There are clearly some people who have still gotten sick, even in this country and across the world. And flu viruses don't disappear. They can infect other animals and they will, you know, hop back into the human population at some point. Whether that's going to be tomorrow or this fall or 2 years from now, it's not exactly clear. I suspect, you know, these viruses will trickle back in as our measures against the coronavirus sort of start to let up. But, you know, that means we're going to need more vaccines. That means we are going to need to deal with more sicknesses. And it's a little tricky to know exactly what the flu is going to look like when it comes back, when we don't have eyes on it right now. Normally during a typical flu season, or really in advance of typical flu season, which for us starts in November, December, in the Southern Hemisphere, that's starting in what our summer months are. So, you know, June to August, we're monitoring those strains that are hopping around the Southern Hemisphere and thinking, well, maybe these are some of the same strains that are going to come trouble us. Let's keep an eye on them. And maybe we'll use some of those exact strains in our vaccines so that we can protect people from what's coming. With so much less data around this year, that's just a lot harder to predict. And, you know, there's also this idea that if we are not dealing with as many flu viruses this year, all that great immunity we built up in previous years, it's not going to go away, but it just doesn't get added to this year. And that might make things trickier in subsequent years, especially for really young kids who maybe now have never had a flu virus in their life.
Here's the thing I've been thinking about, Catherine. Fall of 2019, flu season then, I wouldn't have thought of putting on a mask. I didn't have a mask. Now I have masks. I'm kind of used to wearing them. Don't love it. And I can picture, you know, I go to a grocery store during flu season or get on a bus or whatever. Maybe I'll put my mask on. Do you think we're going to see, are people talking about maybe a culture change in how we think about, you know, preventing flu even post-COVID being really bad?
You know, I hope so. And I will add some nuance to that because I think some people see these numbers about the flu and they think about all the changes that we've made this past year. It's not an either or situation. It's not an on and off switch. There's a middle ground between, you know, the kind of extreme measures we've had to take this year during the pandemic and the measures that we could take in the future to stop really bad flu outbreaks. You know, kind of as you say, like it could be a situation where people just put on masks when they know they're going to go to really crowded places, but it doesn't mean you can't go, you know, hug a grandparent. It doesn't mean that you can never go shopping in a mall. Just the idea of like, you know, maybe more people will stay home when they're sick. Maybe people will be more conscientious about not traveling and not moving around unmasked when they know the flu is really running rampant. The idea here is that we've really proven time and time again this year that we already have the tools to combat the flu. And even if we kind of put them into place to a slightly less degree in the future, they're still going to work. It's all about risk reduction. And I hope this means that flu outbreaks in the future will be much less severe going forward.
Catherine, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Catherine Wu covers science for The Atlantic. We talked to her today about the surprising dip in flu cases this season and what it could mean for, say, next year's. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, join Kate and her guest for a look at a shortage of nurses here in Wisconsin, how that could affect patient care, and what's being done to solve that problem. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill backed by President Biden passed the U.S. House this weekend. We'll look at what's in it and how support in the Senate is shaping up. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network.